and I was called by my mother. So I stayed here about 6 months and found my father in a very bad way. No one knew what he had, really. His great friend, Dr. Julian Loudon, suggested that it was something to do with the pancreas, perhaps the cancer of the pancreas, but no doctor other than Dr. Julian had any idea of what he really suffered from. He had pain and he became lethargic and didn't want to see anybody or do anything and wasn't interested in his business of looking after the land and apartment houses, or he wasn't interested really in anything, and he was disgusted with all the mess that had taken place in Brookwood, which they had rented shortly after the war to a Catholic club recommended by a man called James, who was well known in Toronto. And in the meantime, it had been turned over to a gambling club run by the leading criminal of Toronto at that time, in, you know, dishonesty, gambling, killing, whatnot. So they had had to fight for several years and had only gotten it back just before the end of the war, because there were laws about getting out and nobody would believe my father, and he had to have witnesses and it was a hard pull for him, and I think that was one of the things that bothered him. And then they had enormous sums to pay in changing it back into a house. They had left the house in the year of the war, 1939, and they had thought they'd live out in Victoria and just come back to see how, you know, for business reasons, or to see how things were going, because they had a man called Holtby Metcalf, who'd been with my father nearly 50 years at that time and completely trustworthy, as he thought. Anyway, it was too much for him, the war and every grandchildren being in it, and only seeing the war's end as a triumph for Bolshevism. He said it was a choice that between fascism and Bolshevism, they were just the same. So anyway, he was miserable, as I said, and he had trained nurses to look after him three a day, and nothing, he didn't get better. So at last a urinary specialist said he'd have to go into the hospital. And so he did, and they had all kinds of tests. He went to St. Joseph's, and they didn't help him one little bit. He just got worse and worse, and my mother and I spent most of our time with him, going back and forth to Brookwood. And then one day I saw that he was pretty rummy, and they told me at the hospital that I had better tell my mother to go home because he'd probably die. He was in a coma then. And so I said, well, I would stay. So I said to my mother, go home and have a rest. Anyway, that afternoon, my father got much worse, and they couldn't breathe, and they had to pump out his lungs with machines, and he was really miserable, and he didn't know anything. But just before he died, he called out my name and looked at me. He had beautiful blue eyes, and he looked at me with recognition, and then he died. The nuns who ran the hospital then were very kind and asked me if they could pray for his soul. I said I had no objection. I thought that no one religion had a monopoly on the Supreme Being. So they did. And then I went home to my mother, and she knew, without my telling her from my face, I expect, that Father had died. Well, it was very sad, and then my mother bore up pretty well, and my brother came, she'd called him, and my sister didn't come. My brother came only for a short time, and I had the brunt of arranging things and doing all, you know, the funeral arrangements and and seeing about flowers. Luckily at that time, Brookwood, the garden part and greenhouse was rented to a florist, more or less, who had the place full of flowers. So we took them all, and the house was covered with carnations and whatever there was in the greenhouse. And my father's body was brought back, and the funeral took place from the house. And a clergyman made a short speech about my father. Didn't know anything about my father anyway, and that was that. And so he was buried in Toronto, and there's a burial plot there at the cemetery where I hope to be buried one day. And that was I stayed 6 months to help my mother. Everything was in such a mess, and she knew that Holtby Metcalf was at that time semi-retired, and then he died right after my father. So that was no use. The secretary was a man called Costigan, and he wasn't very capable or very honest. And in fact, he took bribes from everybody, we were told, that he took what was called key money. Whenever he rented an apartment or a house, he took at least $100. So he had quite a nice bank account by that time. And during the war years, you see, he'd been able to profit. And so also, as my father and mother had come back and had to rent a house on Imperial Avenue till Brookwood, till they got the people out of Brookwood who had rented it, who had not rented it, who had taken over from the renters, and had it repaired. Everything was in such a bad way then. And so I stayed till, I think it was August, and then I went back to Egypt, and I had to get permission to take money with me out of the country. And the man, a Jew who ran it here in Toronto, later he was governor of the Bank of Canada, he wouldn't let me take very much. And the airplanes were all going to Europe and the Middle East were grounded, the one that I want to take. So I had to go on an American government ship, which was full of people returning to their different posts, and it was a terrible ship. And we slept in bunks, and there was no way to sit down anywhere. I had to buy an orange crate for $10, I remember, and I had a rug with me. I sat on that, and it took us about 10 days to get, and more, 2 weeks I think it was, to get to Alexandria, where my husband met me, and he was staying in Alexandria then. He had rented my sister's house, who was in England at the time, and hadn't been able to get back to Egypt. She was doing war work in England. She was head of the Worcestershire Women's Land Army. So I stayed then for a while, and then the following year my husband had an accident. Following year my son was in a bad way, and we had to go to Switzerland, where he couldn't breathe. And so we went to Geneva, and the best man in Geneva, who was at the university there, said he would look at my son. And I had money with me, thinking that I'd have to spend it all, and I was terrified. I moved from a hotel where we were living. The Egyptian consul had met me with the money, because my husband had had to arrange it through the consulate. And so we left the hotel, which I was afraid was too expensive, and went to a pension. And then I took Sandy to the doctor, and he said, well, bring him back tomorrow. And so he said all he needs is cauterization. And so he told me that if he had a hemorrhage from his nose, I was to call him. And he explained to me what I should do in case that happened. And I'd had to call him because he did have a hemorrhage, but it was a slight one. And we were very pleased in the pension. The people were exceedingly kind to us. And so we then went to Linzerheide, the doctor said I'd have to take Sandy up in the mountains and walk and get good mountain air to recover, because although he did it, this cauterization, he said it was quite an operation, and he needed to recover from his illness from before. So we were up in Linzerheide for a few weeks, and then we came back to Geneva, and so that my husband had been able to get out, and he'd gone for treatment. He too had trouble with his sinus, and he'd gone to a place in Switzerland for treatment, and he'd also gone to a place he'd just gone to a taken a house there for a short time. Before the war, I'm mistaken. That time we came back directly to Geneva, and my husband joined. He didn't join me then, or rather he did. And then we went back on the plane together. I think we went to Cairo and stayed there. And then the following year, I wanted to go to take Sandy and go to Canada and see my mother, and the girls wanted to go, so we went, and then my husband went to Switzerland to a place to see about his nose, and which he had trouble with because he had it wasn't exactly his nose, but he had sinus trouble, and he'd always suffered from that. So then, when I came back from Canada, I found that my husband had completely changed. Or at least I thought he had changed. And he seemed very funny. And to me, I mean, he wasn't his usual self. We had quite a few lovely horses then, and I found he'd been seeing some English women. And while, before I got back from Switzerland, and he had been lending his horses to them, and then all of a sudden he had a terrible accident, and he was really in a very bad way. They thought that his horse fell on him, and he, you know, couldn't do a thing. He was paralyzed, and they thought that he'd die. So I got a doctor who was a specialist, Dr. Mauro Pasha. He was both a surgeon and an obstetrician, and he got another doctor, I forget his name now, to look at my husband. By then he was in the Anglo-Egyptian hospital. And the doctor then, the English one, said it was hopeless, but Dr. Mauro said there was a chance if I'd take the responsibility, so I did. I signed a paper saying I took all responsibility, and they, both of them, operated on my husband, who his spleen had been crushed and different organs had been crushed inside him with the horse lying on him. So he was really couldn't have been worse. But he had a very strong heart, and he was a healthy man otherwise, and so he lived, although it took him months to recover. And then we went home he came home to the house, and he had nurses, and but his attitude was very odd, and his sisters too, they tried to interfere in everything, because I suppose they thought that he was sick in that they could say what they wanted and do what they wanted. So it got worse and worse, and my husband thought he was young again, and this fall had made him into a eunuch, and of course he couldn't bear that, and he tried to pretend he wasn't, and he'd go out with the women and tell me that he was going to live his own life. It completely changed his mental attitude, so I didn't know what to do. I couldn't stand it there, and Nellie was miserable. Amina had already gone to Canada to stay with my mother, and while going to the university in Toronto. And so I had to decide, and the only thing I could do, I went to the director of passports, who was a Circassian, and I told him that I had to get back, that my mother was very ill, and I got my mother to send a cable saying she needed me to come at once, which she did, and I showed this to the director, and then I told him, oh, my husband is not going to ride again, and he'll give you some of his horses. And so I came back to the house, and I had the permit to get out of Egypt. You had to have a permit to get out. And, of course, my mother had sent me the money to come, but my husband wouldn't let Sandy go. You see, he was the last of the Baroudis, and he insisted on keeping him. He said, you can take Nellie. He'd been very funny with Nellie. He'd wanted her to stay and look after them, and I could go. His mind had completely altered. He was very, very peculiar. And so I wouldn't agree to that, nor would Nellie. And so we had to leave Sandy, poor fellow, and come, the two of us, leave for Canada. And I had to, couldn't take anything but the jewelry I had on me, and Nellie couldn't take her sewing machine, which I'd bought for her in Switzerland, and we had to just leave. We went on the TWA to New York, and then took a plane to Toronto, and so we arrived, and there my mother, I think, was happy to see us, but she was very worried. She had no idea that things had gone so badly for me, because my father and mother had, although initially disapproving of my marriage, had liked Ashraf and gotten very much to like him. So that it was really too sad, the whole thing. But that's what happened. And so we had to make our lives over, so to speak. And my husband went around trying to tell everybody that how badly I treated him. And he got my sister, helped him in this. She used to go and see him. She was back from England by that time. And my brother-in-law was then back at the British Embassy. He was legal advisor to all the countries in the Near East except Iran, and had a plane to go around in, and of course had got a great deal more income from his new position. So all in all, it was an unhappy time for me, and I expect for Nellie, who had seen how her father had changed. Amina hadn't seen. She had missed all this. And poor Sandy, who had to be sacrificed, because I knew my husband wouldn't bother about him at all. He didn't give two hoots about children, as once he had had this accident and he thought he was a young man again, and had completely, well, he'd gone off his head, I thought. And so did most of his old friends. They didn't recognize him. And I don't want to talk about it. It was too sad, because I loved him very much. And I can't speak about it sensibly, because it hurt me at the time, and I want to forget it now and only think of the happiness I had with him and not the unhappiness. So Nellie went to the art school here, and I had to keep an eye on the office. I used to go in, and gradually I found that my mother at first didn't believe everything, but she knew that Elmer had been robbing her because although she had an enormous income, she had nothing left over. It all went in expenses. And she didn't spend a great deal. She didn't spend her income. We couldn't understand it. So bit by bit, proof came against him. And I had to tell her, well, I can't go on like this. I can't look after things with a dishonest man in the office. And she said, well, I'll go in and tell him to go. And which she did. She told him, Elmer, I thought you would bury me, but I am burying you. So that's it. So then the whole thing fell on me, of course, because I had only one person in the office who wasn't very good. And I had to be there every day. And this went on for nearly 2 years, trying different men who all were equally incompetent or dishonest, although they came very well recommended. One man I remember had been the chief accountant of the Farmers Cooperative Ontario, and as soon as he arrived in the office, he wanted my mother to give him a power of attorney to sign checks. And another one that we got, he couldn't do anything properly, and we had a great inflated sense of his own importance, wouldn't carry his briefcase anywhere to his car, although we provided a car for them all, and he wouldn't do anything out of the way as beneath, finding it beneath his dignity. So in the end, I had to get a woman because a man wouldn't work for me. They all thought I didn't know anything and that they knew everything, although they were, many of them, so cheap that it's impossible to think how cheap they were. I remember one man who had been a bank manager and came very highly recommended, just retired bank manager, and he used to write letters to his mother and enclose an envelope stamped from the office for her to write back. That was just a sample, but that wasn't, I mean, that was the least of it. One man just gambled and robbed everybody in sight, and you know, he would take the money from the rents and go and gamble, and then he couldn't put it back, and so the accounts, when we asked for the monthly accounts, monthly statement, he couldn't produce it. So he had to go, and anyway, finally I got a woman called Graham, and Miss Graham stayed with me for 16 years, and she was very good, but not capable of deciding on her own. If I left any decision about anything, such as getting a painter and looking for several painters to get their prices, she would choose the most expensive one. So that wasn't a help to me. But there you are. Life is always a struggle, and especially for me, I had to learn on the job, so to speak. And Mother, by that time, her asthma was better because I had taken all the responsibility over. And I had to look after the office, and we had very poor maids who couldn't cook. It was very difficult to get anybody decent, and so I had to cook half the time as well as go to the office. So I don't know how, thinking back, I don't know how I did it, but I did, and I pulled everything together. And at the time, we had a very good lawyer called Mr. Cawthorn, whom my father had gotten before he was ill. And he was very capable and a great help to me. If I asked him anything legal, he just took him about 3 minutes to give me the right answer. So I didn't want to do anything that would get the estate or myself or Mother in trouble, and I always checked with him. And so I managed, and then in every way through Mr. Cawthorn, really, who the rest I had to do myself and decide. But then I increased the income of the estate part, for instance. It had been $600 a year, and I increased it to $3,000 and more. And the mother's similarly, because money had been going out the window. Things had been paid for and repaid for, supposedly, because there weren't any receipts for a lot of things. and so there was no proof. And paint had been bought for the apartment houses and houses, and then supposedly been used, but had been resold to friends of Elmer's. This was in his day. And as for the last one, before Miss Graham, the compulsive gambler, he just wanted to play poker. And that was, and yet he'd been also chief accountant in a big firm for years. And his mother was an accountant, chief accountant, I believe, at Simpson's. And as, you know, they were, it came a respectable family, but didn't mean a thing, evidently. So I had to go through all this apprenticeship until I knew, but luckily I managed, and so we were able to live reasonably well, and my mother had a large income and could do anything she wanted, and so we had, mother had an old car, and I sold it, and we bought a new one, Oldsmobile, and then I got a Volkswagen bus for the office. And because the car used, you know, they had a car they could use all the time and everything. And I don't think it went out much on office work or to the apartment houses or houses. And I made a lot of economies in many things. And, of course, it took work and time. And I was able to take Mother away once to Bermuda and once or twice down to the Caribbean for a change, and I took her to North Carolina also. So we lived very comfortably. Of course, I couldn't forget what had happened to me. My husband by that time was dead, and he died foolishly through doing too much. He couldn't play golf properly because they told him he had to be careful after such an accident. But he went on as though he were a young man, and he died in Switzerland in the meantime of a heart attack, and left everything, of course, by Muslim law. He had to leave it to his children. But my children have never seen hide nor hair of it, because between Nasser and Sadat, who one lot confiscated everything belonging to the previous ruling class, that is the Turco-Circassians, and the other gave it back and then reconfiscated, so it's still there. My children haven't been able to get it, and they don't want to go and stay there in order to get it. They wanted me to go, but I've had enough here hanging on to what they got through me without going on a wild goose chase and tiring myself out in trying to cope with an upside-down Egypt who today, from what I can make out, is in a bad way, overpopulated and run by people who are not very capable. I understand even the tramway companies and the telephone companies and everything are in a mess. And I understand that it's so many people in the, even the city, people are living in the City of the Dead, which was a Muslim cemetery for the old families from the time of the Mamluks, and people are living there. And I understand that houses are right up to the pyramids, where it used to be land and villages, and it's suburbia right up to the pyramids. So I have no wish to see it. I had happy times in Egypt and happy memories, and I was happy till my husband's catastrophe. And so I just have to, I've made the best of it here, and my children, I think, have Nellie married a nice man, a decent man, whose family were an old Scottish family here, and Amina, well, she had a hard time, but she got over it. She went into England, learned to be a nurse, and then taught nursing, and then she's back here nursing. She's a psychiatric nurse because they wouldn't accept her degrees from England or her teaching capabilities. And Sandy was with the Brinko, that is the Newfoundland, British Newfoundland Company, and who made Churchill Falls, and then he went into a uranium company and went out west, and then he decided to work on his own. He wasn't happy being away all the time. He was either in Japan or in Germany or in France or somewhere for these big companies, and his family didn't see much of him. He was living in Montreal by that time, and so he didn't. He decided now that the children were older, where do they want to be? And they want to come back to Toronto. And they